The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, so what I'd like to do this evening is teach something which is kind of fresh on my mind. And it's going to be a survey, or I like to think of it as a journey, of a particular approach to understanding and engaging in the Buddhist path of practice. And for those of you who might be interested in the context for Buddhist meditation, for mindfulness, this kind of survey overview will kind of provide the larger context for mindfulness. And it's a little bit inspired because by a program that I taught today for this year, for about 8 months, once a month I teach a day-long program called Entering the Stream, which is going through kind of systematically kind of this wider context for the practice we have. And so that's fresh in my mind. It's coming out of that program and how that program is constructed to offer you this kind of survey or this kind of journey. And you might think of this as a journey, if you can follow along, or if I can figure out how to take you along. So it's a journey that goes from first understanding what the Dharma is, when the Buddha teaches the Dharma, what that means, Indian word, and it ends with becoming fully awake, fully liberated, and living a life, a liberated life. So it begins with what's called the Dharma. It's a very strong, powerful word in Indian religions. The word Dharma sometimes is almost not synonymous with our word religion. Someone's Dharma, someone's teaching, is kind of their religious teachings that they have, the way of life that they have. And different Indian religions, traditions have dharmas, have teachings or ways of living or understandings of what it means to be alive in this world. And the word Dharma has a kind of a very wholesome connotations in much of India and Buddhism, Indian, but especially in Buddhism. What the Dharma is all that's good in life. What's a Dharma, which is not Dharma, is injustice, is what's not morally helpful and skillful, what's not what's unskillful, what's unwholesome. So in the teachings of the Buddha, the Dharma, his teachings and what he emphasized, has a particular meaning. And to understand that meaning, you understand the entry point to the Dharma practice. And the Buddha once said that there are many people teaching spiritual paths in his time, 2,500 years ago. And he said that there were basically three types: those who follow tradition and books and teachings that have been passed down through the generations, so it's learned teachings; those who rely on gods and rituals, so things that are outside of yourself; and then those people who rely on their own direct experience. And the Buddha said, I'm one of those who is relying on your own experience. That doesn't seem too revolutionary for, I think, many people here in the modern West, where their own experience is kind of, you know, if anything, we've overemphasized it. But the idea that we're touching into what the Dharma is in practice through the gate of our own experience. And then the Buddha defined the Dharma, his teachings, that which is immediately visible, directly visible, to be seen for oneself, that is open, inviting inspection, or open to discover for yourself, meaning it's not a secret. It's just like it's pretty available. It's kind of pretty explicit what it's about. It's in your direct experience somehow. And he also said that it's immediate. It's not something that takes a long, long study to understand, but it's to be found somehow in the immediacy of your experience here and now. He also said it was something to be experienced by the wise. But then he said one more thing about it, and then he said that it's onward leading. So it's something about connecting to your direct experience here and now, in the immediacy of now. But there's something about doing that that opens up a path, opens up a journey, opens up a conveyor belt, or in the ancient language, maybe a stream, a current that you get into that will lead you to freedom. So, but to do that, you have to really learn how to be in the present moment. And that's a big part of what mindfulness practice is about, is to learn how to be really here. Not in a momentary way, not in a casual way, not in a kind of way, but to really be centered and focused in your experience here and now in a very rich and immediate and full way. So you're not distracted. We're not easily swayed by the thoughts and drift off, but we're, you know, you not only you're here in your moment of experience, but you know you're here. It's kind of like you're rooted. Boom, I'm here. And what that does is that it begins opening up insight, begins opening up an avenue to see clearly what is here. And the one thing that the Buddha emphasized more than anything else that allows this onward movement of practice to liberation is to have, in the present moment experience, to have a direct insight, direct seeing of how things arise and pass, the impermanent nature of phenomena. That and he emphasized it so much that that it's happening all the time, this constant impermanence, that the most reasonable way to understand what he was talking about was he wasn't talking about the constant arising and passing of the floor and the building and the roof, but what he was talking about was the constant changing nature of how we experience our world around us, the floor and the roof and the walls and people and ourselves, that how we process the sense data that comes into our world and how we reconstruct that into being our concepts, ideas of the world we live in, how we perceive the world is a constant shifting and changing phenomena. The mind is constantly moving and aware of many, many things that are happening one after the other. And there's something very dramatic and very important about resting, being at ease, being in the present moment so much that you're not fixated on something, but you're beginning to sense, wow, things are constantly shifting and moving and flowing. And this opens up to some of the powerful other insights of Buddhism. And one of them is that we spend a lot of time as human beings projecting concepts on the world around us. We're projection machines with our concepts and ideas. And some of the things that we project is we project sense of constancy or permanence in our experience, that it's not actually changing as quickly as it actually is. And because we kind of need to generalize, in order to get through this world, we can't live in a world that's constantly shifting and changing. We have to simplify and create these simplified concepts that help us find our way. If you're walking in the forest and you've learned the path, you kind of want that path to kind of be more or less the same from day to day. You don't want to be focusing on how everything's always changing all the time. You want to focus on how it's always there so you can find your way where you go. So it's a useful skill that the mind has, but it's also one that gets us in trouble when we want things to be the same, or we see things as the same. So you can see that sometimes with how people treat you occasionally. That someone, you know, once upon a time, maybe 20 years ago, you kind of messed up a little bit. You kind of let something slip out of your mouth that kind of hurt someone. Maybe you were a little bit irritated, teeny bit, maybe. For the next 20 years, that person's, every time you see that person, the person's cautious around you because they have this idea that you are an irritating person to be with. You have an anger problem. And that's the fixed idea they have of who you are. And you want to kind of shake them or kind of, you know, 20 years ago, I've changed, I've grown. I've done years of spiritual practice, and I was easily irritated back then, but I'm not that person anymore. But that person insists on seeing you that way. And so we do that to each other all the time, where we see each other in fixed ideas, we have old ideas, and we're not there to receive the person in a new way. I had a very, for me, kind of a little bit painful experience of this many years ago when I was working as a cook in a restaurant, and there was a change of shifts. And I was finishing my shift, was in the changing room, and the next shift was coming in, and the man was coming in was a friend of mine. And I was in a good mood, and I kind of just operating on the assumption that he was him, like he usually is. And so as soon as I saw him, I kind of did some kind of joke, some kind of silly joke or something. And then I was very quickly aware that he was not in a mood for it. Turned out that one of his best friends had just died. So I was, operating on an assumption that I knew who he was, rather than being present to discover who he was, how he was different in that moment. And so this idea, we're all changing and shifting, and it's dangerous to rest on our memories and ideas of what people are, what the world is. And so if you start seeing how shifting and changing experience are, is then it's easier to start seeing how much projection we project on top of the world. And one of the clearest times I saw this, not so much with impermanence, but when I first went to live in a monastery, a Buddhist monastery, which is down in Big Sur, Tassajara Zen Monastery. After I was there for a while, doing a lot of meditation, I would just kind of stop sometimes and look at the trees. And there are a lot of wonderful oak trees and different things down there. And I was surprised that it became very clear to me that I was painting, that was the language I had for myself, painting the tree on top of the tree. Meaning I had a concept that this was a tree. It was an accurate enough concept, it was a tree. But it was clear that there was a tree there, and there was a concept my mind was making, and I was seeing the tree through the filter of those concepts. And that was kind of eye-opening for me to see how that worked. Because normally, before that, the concept and the object in the world, I just thought they were the same. But when I started seeing, oh, there's a layer that goes on between me and the thing, even the most innocent thing, like seeing a tree, that opened the door for me to begin understanding how many of my ideas made fixed concepts on the world. Fixed ideas of myself, fixed ideas of others, of what should happen, all kinds of things. And as I continued practicing, the grip of these ideas of fixity began to relax and to soften. The other thing that when you start seeing how things are constantly changing is that many of the ideas of self, self-identity that we have, we're oftentimes come along with the idea of this is who I am. And whereas someone can do it, we can see how other people do it to us. After 20 years, they're still seeing us the same way. It's much harder to see how we do it for ourselves. And we also can live under these fixed ideas, this is who I am. And we have ideas of me and myself and mine. And we're stuck on these, this is it, this is defines it. Pretty much the Buddha said, anytime you define yourself, you limit yourself. I don't know if I agree completely, but there is a very strong tendency that when we define ourselves, if we can get stuck on that, get attached to that, then we do limit ourselves with that attachment. So there's something about staying completely in the present moment and really learning to see the flow and the change of the present moment that also begins to loosen up the grip of self-concepts that many people struggle under. But seeing this impermanent world that we live in, the changing nature, is also very important in Buddhism, because impermanence or change is not chaos. It's not random how things change in the impermanent world. But things change, things are impermanent, according to the conditions that influence them. So if you take a ball and put it on the top of a hill, that's a condition for the ball to roll downhill. But if you put the ball at the bottom of the hill, it's not going to roll anywhere. So it's an impermanent world in a sense, but what you do, what the conditions are, affects which direction it goes. So the Buddha put a tremendous emphasis on teachings of what's called conditionality. That when certain conditions are in place, other things are liable to happen. So there are some conditions, if we put in our lives, that lead to suffering. There are other conditions in our life that lead to freedom from suffering. And it's up to us, to some degree, what conditions we contribute. And the conditions we contribute influence whether we suffer or don't suffer. So if I'm really have a fixed idea of what I want, and I have to have it, and the whole world has to change because of my desire, that attachment and clinging is a condition. Now, if the whole world, cooperates, maybe there's a kind of happiness. But, the world is not usually so sympathetic, so automatically to every desire we have. And if you're holding on to it tightly, you'll get disappointed, maybe worse. You'll suffer. If you have a desire, but you don't clutch on it, don't cling to it, but hold it lightly and look around and see, is this a reasonable desire? And is it appropriate to pursue in a light way and not be attached? And then that might lead to very different conditions. It might mean that if your desire is not fulfilled, you're kind of relaxed about it. Now, I didn't really expect it too much. I tried my best, but it didn't work out. But I wasn't my happiness wasn't dependent on that desire. And so that leads to a different result. So the conditions that we put in place, the conditions of how we are, can affect these two paths, the path toward suffering and the path away from suffering. And so the Buddha had a lot of teachings about conditionality. He had teachings about a whole series of things that are the conditions for suffering. And the shorthand of that version is that craving is a primary condition for our suffering. But he also had a whole series of teachings about the conditions that lead to freedom from suffering. And some of these things are quite nice. And some of them are kind of like a series of conditions, one after the other. One leads to the other. And to give you a sense of how nice these are, there was five conditions that happen in sequence in these teachings that are gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, and concentration. That for the Buddha, if you put in place certain conditions, at some point they give rise to gladness. When the gladness becomes strong, that's a condition for joy. When the joy becomes strong, that's a condition for relaxation, tranquility. When the tranquility and relaxation is there, that's a condition for a kind of deep, sublime happiness. And happiness is a condition for concentration. Not a few Buddhist meditators try to get concentrated directly. And they strain, they push, they bear down on their experience. Like, I have to get concentrated. I've done this and ended up not concentrated, but ended up with a headache. And for the Buddha, concentration is something that's useful to have, but it depends on certain appropriate conditions to be there first. And the conditions are conditions like to be relaxed and to have some modicum of happiness and well-being and joy. So then the idea is, what are the conditions that help put that into place? So the Buddha put a lot of emphasis on living ethically, ethical life. If you want to really have a reliable kind of sense of happiness and well-being and relaxation, don't go around robbing banks. That's not going to help that process. Don't spend a lot of time lying. Don't hurt people. Don't cause harm in the world. That's a condition. You want to cultivate a meditation practice, maybe, a practice of being present. You can't really develop strong sense of happiness, joy, tranquility, unless you're really present. And that means that if you want to be really present, sometimes you have to face your demons, face the things that you've been running away from for a long time. So sometimes it's, you know, seems like you're going the wrong direction at first. But you have to understand the unresolved issues in our hearts and our minds and work through them. And then as you work through them, that supports a sense of well-being, a sense of relaxation, and that supports the arising of concentration. So part of the reason the Buddha taught conditionality is so we can study what conditions we can put in place that supports us in our life. Conditionality, this idea of practice has to do with conditions, is distinct from the idea of practice has to do with having causes. It has to do more with being tending our garden than causing the plants to grow. You know, a gardener goes into the garden and plants a seed, but doesn't go tug on the plant to grow, doesn't cause it to grow, but cultivates it, waters, fertilizes, removes the weeds, so that the plant's natural process can grow and develop. So the same thing in our hearts and minds. There's wonderful seeds, seed for liberation, seeds for love, seeds for happiness that are there. And that's our garden, and we tend it by creating the conditions that support it. This idea of creating the conditions rather than being the causal agent for a spiritual life is very important, because to be caught up in the idea that I'm the cause, I'm responsible, I'm the doer, is really a drag if you do a lot of meditation. It's kind of like a very heavy sense of duty or expectation, or becomes kind of like that one image I like is that of, are you the cause for your cat to purr, or are you the condition for it to purr? If I'm the cause of the cat to purr, I'm just going to press down as hard as I can, you know, really get that response the best I can, you know. But the cat knows the difference. But, you know, I have to kind of create the conditions. And, you know, sometimes we have a cat, and sometimes the cat is not interested whatsoever. And, you know, and how much I try to pet the cat, nothing happens. And other times I do it, the cat begins to purr. And I don't really feel like I'm the cause of the cat purring, but if I do it right, I'm the condition for it. The cat's receptive. So our inner life can purr. But if we're trying to be the cause for it, then that interferes with this very subtle operation of the heart to operate, this singing of the heart that can happen in meditation or in practice. So this idea of putting conditions in place is a central part of the Buddha's teachings. And so we kind of try to figure out what are the conditions we can do. And then it's kind of like we put the conditions in place, then Dharma willing, things begin to open up and unfold. To give you an example of this, concentration is an important part of meditation practice. I've been doing meditation practice now for over 40 years. And there are times where I get nicely concentrated. It feels very nice. Now, to this day, I don't feel that I cause myself to get concentrated. When there's that shift, kind of a quantum shift inside, that kind of I feel, oh, now I'm really here in a concentrated way, I feel like it's a gift. I put the conditions in place, and then if reality is ready, if the cat is ready to purr, then reality purrs for me. I get concentrated. But I don't feel like I'm the cause of it. And I'm kind of very happy, because in the early days when I was practicing, when I thought I had to be the cause of it, it was not pretty. I had a lot of suffering. So now it's very nice. It's kind of like a double pleasure. Because on one hand, getting concentrated is very pleasant and enjoyable by itself. On the other hand, I feel it's a gift. And to have those two together is quite nice. So then the Buddha talked about putting these conditions in place, and then his description of the path, the practice, how it unfolds, at some point it becomes less and less about doing, even putting conditions in place, but becomes more like water flowing down the mountain. And the analogy he used was putting rain falling on the mountainside, and if it rains a lot, then the raindrops, some of the raindrops don't get absorbed in the soil, but rather they run down the hill. And then the raindrops find each other, become bigger drops, and then the bigger drops find each other, and after a while it becomes a little stream. And then after a while the stream becomes a little creek, the creek becomes a little river, the river becomes a big river, and eventually it flows down into the ocean. And it's and unless there's obstacles along the way, the water will just keep flowing downhill. And if you want the water to flow, your job is not to go out there with a big broom, you know, sweeping the water downhill, and go, go, go. Your job, if anything, is to remove the obstacles, the boulders that might be there, and just so it keeps flowing and going. So at some point, practice is more about removing the obstacles than it is about making something happen. And there's a natural momentum that begins to move and unfold. And to enter into this world where the natural momentum of practice, the mind or the heart, begins to flow or to move or to keep opening up by itself, entering more and more deeply into the present moment, is a great pleasure. It's a great delight. So as we go deeper and deeper, then a number of things happen. One is that the mind or the heart becomes softer. It becomes more pliable or more receptive. And it becomes, one of the words in the ancient language is workable or pliable. Because a mind that's stressed and strained is kind of hard. And it's hard to for it to kind of soften and change. But once the mind gets soft and relaxed, then it can begin to shift and change. And how we want it to change is we want it to be able to release the grip of its attachments. So an example of this kind of softening of the mind that I learned from my son's kindergarten is once a week in his kindergarten class, kids would play with beeswax. Colored beeswax, and they'd make it into little animals or different things. And so when it was time to play with a beeswax, the teacher would say, go up and get the wax, and then the kids would put it in their palm of their hand, between the two hands, between the two palms, so it could get warm. Because cold beeswax is brittle. The only thing you can do with it is break it. It's not soft enough to be able to make into some art. So the teacher would have them put it into the palm of their hand, and just hold it there gently, and so the heat of the hands would slowly warm it up, while the teacher told the kids a story. And so the kids would be engaged, listening to the story, holding their beeswax. By the time the story was over, the beeswax would be soft, and then the kids would make it into their beautiful little art. And it was done. They put it up on the shelf, would be for the next week until they made it something next time. So part of the function of this meditation and practice is to soften the brittleness or the hardness of the mind. Because if you try to change your mind as an act of force, when it's cold, it'll just break, if anything, if you have any luck at all. But once the mind gets soft and relaxed, then it's workable, it's pliable, it's ready for some kind of, it's receptive. And as the mind gets more and more concentrated, we start seeing some of the deeper and deeper kind of roots of our attachments, what we're holding on to, what we're believing, what we're... And one of the fascinating things we see is we start seeing that actually those also are arising and passing. They're not permanent. They don't characterize reality that it's this way. But we start seeing as the things loosen up and soften that our attachments are coming and going, arising and passing. Our thoughts about who we are coming and going, arising and passing all the time. And then a fascinating question is, who are you in between your thoughts? Who are you when you don't use thoughts to tell you? Who are you when you don't use thoughts to answer the question? Who are you in between your attachments? What is there? What's that? You're still alive and aware and present. What is there between when you're not defining yourself, when you're not criticizing yourself, when you're not judging yourself, or you're not kind of pursuing your desires, and these are rising and passing, and there's a gap or a pause between them? What is life there like? What kind of freedom is found there? What kind of peace is found there? What kind of alternative view, understanding of life is found there when our life is not being seen through the filter of concepts, ideas, desires, wishes, attachments? So we go deeper and deeper in seeing this. And at some point, in a sense, that gap between thoughts, the gap between desires, the gap between identity and holding on, becomes kind of big enough, and it's kind of like we fall through into that which is on the other side of that. And, it can be a little bit frightening, the idea, because it's kind of unknown on the other side. What's known is the concepts, ideas we live under. There are some people who don't want to let go of even their suffering, because their suffering is what they know, what they're familiar with. They grew up with it, it's what they know, it's how they feel, somehow paradoxically kind of safe because it's the known world. But to be willing to drop our attachments, to drop our attachment to suffering, to wanting things, to our aversions, our resentments, our plans, and kind of pass through in this gap that opens up. And the other side of that is peace. The other side of that is the releasing and the freedom that comes from that wonderful release, that emptiness of not being attached. The analogy I like to use for this is that of a fist, that if you hold a fist really tight for a long time, 20 years, something, and it hurts, but you really think it's important to have a fist. And, just you've learned to defend yourself, so you keep it really close at hand, ready to use whenever you need to. But it hurts. You feel like your life's getting pretty limited by always having a fist. And then finally it occurs to you, well, maybe I can take a break. And so you release the fist, you open it up. And after 20 years, it feels so good to have the fist opened up and relaxed. And now, that freedom of the open hand, where someone else might think, that's nothing, what's the big deal? You go around, show them your open hand, and they think you're kind of crazy. But for you, after 20 years one way, this is like remarkable. Wow, it feels so good. When we spend a lifetime holding on to certain attachments, holding on to certain suffering, certain bracing ourselves, certain kind of defensiveness, certain kind of all kinds of things that we get stuck in, the movement of that release, of opening up, letting go, is quite profound. And it can make a very memorable impression on a person, where now they have a deep, deep appreciation for what it's like to have the heart, have the mind to be free, no longer tightened up in a fist. It opens up. So in Buddhism, we call this sometimes letting go or release, a deep, deep letting go and release. But it's a letting go of clinging, of grasping in the mind. It doesn't necessarily mean we're letting go of something. So if I hold a striker in my hand and I hold it for 20 years and it's like enough already, I'm just like cold, always holding on to it. So finally, I let go of it. Let go of the clinging. In that letting go, there's two possible ways of letting go. One way is simply drops out of my hand and it's gone. The other way is I'm letting go of the clinging, the hand opens up, but in the open hand, the striker rests in the hand. That deep release that can happen may or may not come with dropping something, or may or might not come with simply we open it, hands up, and whatever we're holding onto, we still have, but now we're holding it lightly. We're not gripping it anymore. And that's part of the wisdom of practice, is to know what to drop and what to simply open up and hold lightly. Some things are just not worth keeping. Some things are worth keeping, but they're not worth clinging to. But you can still have them this way. So this release, this freedom, is in Buddhism is considered to be one of the primary goals of practice, because it really sets the heart free, sets the mind free. And when the mind is free, the heart is free, then we can walk through our lives in a much happier way, more peaceful way, and then hopefully we become a gift to the world. We become responsive to the world. And the way that some of these early tradition talked about it is that you become radiant. But if you form a conceit around being the radiant one, that doesn't work. It's kind of like you have this fist for a long time, your hand finally opens up, wow, that felt so good. And having an open hand is the best. And you start feeling, I want that, more of that. So what do? You grasp at it. And as soon as you grasp at it, you're back at a fist. You can't have an open hand and a fist at the same time. So some of this radiance, some of this deep peace that the Buddha was pointing to is simply not something that you can grasp onto and cling to, because it arises out of that openness, that release, that freedom. So mindfulness practice in the Buddhist context is one of the conditions that puts us on this path that goes towards developing insight into impermanence, insight into how we project onto our world, ideas of permanence, ideas of concepts, projects ideas of self onto the world. And we begin to loosen that up enough so that we begin seeing more deeply, putting together the practices and the conditions that allow for the mind to soften, feel good about itself, to become happy and settled, and so that we can start entering into this flow, this momentum of the mind moving to more and more freedom, greater and greater concentration, until such a point where the mind is focused enough and clear enough that we can start seeing what I'm calling tonight the gaps in the experience, rather than kind of always seeing things as being, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but it's kind of like going to the movies and you're enamored with the movie in some way or other, or maybe frightened by it or something. It's just like the movie, it's like everything. But then the movie slows down, and you start seeing individual, still shots that make up the movie appearing on the screen. And then you start seeing little gaps that happen between the switching of each individual frame. Then you see that gap is quite large. And then you go to investigate. And then you go through that gap. And it turns out that you're not in Kansas anymore. It turns out that there's a whole other world of freedom that's there, that you can't see if you're caught up in the concepts and ideas that we live in our world. So that is one way of putting mindfulness into the context of the Buddhist path. There are other ways of describing this. So if this didn't have any meaning for you or is kind of boring to listen to, and you can just forget it. But maybe it gives you a sense, And what I'd like to say, and then the last point, is that every moment of mindfulness, no moment of mindfulness is ever wasted. And I say that because when I talk about a path and this kind of momentum and where it all goes, and you know, it's kind of like, it can seem like a wonderful goal someday in the future. One of the conditions for suffering is to spend too much time concerned about where it's all going. It's really a good condition to learn to be just present with what you have here and now. And that's the mindfulness practice. Trust the mindfulness. Try to just really be here for your life as it's lived. And as you do that, the Dharma will be revealed, and this present moment experience that's the Dharma is onward leading. You don't have to be in charge. You don't have to be too actively involved in wanting or guiding or making it happen. You'll be put on this wonderful path to freedom. And there's a wonderful analogy that Buddha gave for this. I don't know how meaningful it is for us, but it gets the idea. Buddha said that if a chicken sits on her eggs, and the chickens are viable, she just keeps sitting on them. She can have the thought, I don't want these eggs to hatch. Don't hatch. No matter how much she wants them not to hatch, if she's sitting on them and incubating them, they will hatch. And the Buddha said, amazingly enough, he said, if you put all the right conditions in place, even if you had the wish, I do not want to be liberated. I don't want to be awakened. I don't want to get enlightened. You will. So don't get too caught up in, you know, the desires and wanting to get something from this practice. But the idea is to really figure out the condition of how to be here, fully here, and have the deep trust where you can just rest and be present for this experience here. And that's onward leading. And it can lead to liberation, to freedom. So thank you very much.